Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 17th of March, 2021, and you're listening to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of online news at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. Happy Paddy's Day, although I don't think we'll be doing much to celebrate it this year.
Happy what's day?
St. Patrick.
Oh, I didn't realise it's St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, have to go out and drink Guinness, or stay in and drink Guinness.
So here we are again, once more, discussing the news of the week. So what's caught your eye this week, Phil?
Big sigh. I've been overwhelmed by all kinds of reports about all kinds of important things, which I've been trying to pull together in my head so we can talk about them. But essentially, it all comes around what the future employment needs, an immediate future employment needs of the construction industry are, the amount of people we need to recruit, how are we going to get young people to choose construction as a career, and why we need them. And coupled with this, a big part of the background is this whole net zero, which is a shorthand for making what you used to call it environmentally friendly, but taking carbon out of the built environment, particularly out of the existing built environment. I can't remember what the statistic is, but most of the buildings that we're going to have in 20 years' time have already been built. And most of us live in a house fuelled by carbon fuels. Most of us don't have ground source heat pumps or whatever. And there's a huge drive to decarbon, to make Britain net zero by 2050 and do things by 2030 and so on, including, I've got a figure here, 600,000 heat pumps a year will be being installed by 2028 in 7 years' time. At the moment, 30,000 are being delivered. I'm surprised it's that high, actually. So there's just a huge amount.
Per year, is that?
A year.
Is that every year? Oh, right, okay.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe in the past year, because we haven't been doing it for very long. But we will need 600,000 a year by 2028, is the statistic I've got from the government's 10-point plan. So there's just all these different reports from the CITB, Construction Leadership Council, and various other organisations saying this is the way forward. But I think where I'd like to start is something which I think is slightly easier to get our head around, is a survey done by the house builder Redrow.
Oh, right, yes.
And Redrow does I don't know how many years have been doing it, but they do an annual survey. Oh, this is fifth year. They've done it for the fifth annual survey of young people, and I think they interview parents and teachers, about attitudes towards, do you want to work in the construction industry? Might you want to work in the construction industry? Mm. If not, why not? And that sort of thing. And what they found is, unsurprisingly, but it's interesting because it confirms everything you might think was logical, is that over the past year, the natural inclination for bright and ambitious young people to want to go to university has softened, and there's much more warmth to get a job with education or training tied into it, like an apprenticeship or some other form of on-the-job learning. And that is, I think, positive news. I mean, you and I come from an age where our parents would very much want us to, you know, pass our A-levels and go to university, and that was sort of, you know, that's the way to a brighter future. But I would hate to be at university now. And in fact, if I was a 18, 19-year-old, I'd be doing everything I could to put off, maybe think about university in the future, but it can't be. I mean, you've got children at university now, haven't you, I think?
Well, actually, none of them are actually at university at the moment, and thereby hangs a tale. My son graduated last year, and his last term, I suppose, has just spent revising. But he was squirreled away in his student digs in Bath, doing his revision for his finals. My daughter did start at university in the last academic year, but dropped out at Christmas. She wants to do zoology, so she's doing it's an entry course for a zoology degree anyway. So none of them are actually at university at the moment. But I can imagine that for students who are studying for a university degree at the moment, they must be feeling pretty shortchanged because, you know, I know that you go there to learn and get your qualification, and that's obviously the primary objective. But going to university is more than just going to get a degree. It's learning how to live on your own, away from home, away from your parents. It's developing your social skills. It's all sorts of other things as well.
And stop being so posh. It's about going out and getting shit-faced and partying, pub crawls. That's what it's
well,
about.
That was, yeah, all right. And that's the blunt way of putting it. I tried to dress it up a little bit. But I mean, I think it's a rite of passage, isn't it? And if really, if university, study for university is simply just an extension of being at school or just doing a lot of homework, then I think that you basically, for your £9,000 tuition, £9,000 a year tuition fee, not really getting value for money. So I can perfectly understand why people over the past year, young people, school leavers, people who are thinking of going into higher education, have had second thoughts. And I've often thought, in fact, many times, it's nothing to do with my own kids, but John Major and then Tony Blair after him sort of had this push to try and get everybody a university degree. And John Major, I think, was the one who kicked off this process by which every higher education college or...
Well, all the polytechnics became universities, was it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they all became universities. Yeah, and then Tony Blair followed it up and said that he wanted 50% of school leavers to go to university, which at the time I thought was ridiculous, because I heard somebody wisecrack, "Well, who's going to cut my hair? You know, we need people with practical skills. I mean, there's no point going to university and getting a media studies degree if you're going to come out of there and nobody wants to employ you. You're always going to need hairdressers and tire fitters and bricklayers and people like that. And they can study for good, solid vocational qualifications, which will give them a career for the rest of their lives. And, you know, and some of them will use those skills with to launch their own businesses and be very successful and earn loads of money, maybe more than they would have done if they'd gone to university and done sociology. I just think that vocational qualifications are undervalued. I think they've been undervalued for a very long time. And I think that it's quite right that now, under the current circumstances, people are beginning to realise this. They're beginning to see that actually this isn't as much fun for a start as I thought it was going to be, and maybe it's not going to give me the earning potential that I could have otherwise. So I think that I'm not at all surprised to hear that people are opting to, I think the phrase is, you know, learn and earn, actually earn a salary while you're actually learning for your, studying for your qualifications. So one of the things which did surprise me, one of the things I was going to say, because I read this story, and I was going to say one of the things which surprised me, in actual fact, I don't think I was surprised, was the role of parents and their attitudes towards their children going and studying for an apprenticeship or moving into construction. Quite a widespread assumption amongst parents. I think they spoke to about 2,000 parents, didn't they, for this study?
As parents and young people, 2,000 people,
yeah,
all
okay,
in all.
Right, okay, fine. But I think something like, not a sizable minority, I think it's about 17 or 18% of the parents, said that they assumed that a career in construction doesn't require anything more than a few GCSEs. And I think 11% of them said they would actively discourage their children from pursuing a career in construction because it's seen as a low-skilled job and isn't going to equip them with the earning potential which maybe they should get otherwise.
I think the problem is that
that's right.
People see construction as a job, and of course it's not a job. It's myriad jobs. It's
yeah.
like saying that if a parent wanted their son to be a, or daughter to be a brain surgeon, and they ended up being a hospital porter, or vice versa. I mean, the point is, they're both in healthcare, in the medical sector.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, one is seen as high status and the other is not seen as high status. And there needs to be an understanding that construction has got every status within it.
And also, a lot of people, I think, if you look at some of the business leaders in construction at the moment, a lot of them came in at the ground floor. A lot of them did come in through the vocational route as apprentices. And, you know, they had the natural ability to run projects, run businesses, and they've worked their way up.
I would point any sceptical parent to the Sunday Times rich list, and you go through the rich list and see how many people have come from, okay, some of them are second generation, but some of these big families, rich families, their money comes from construction and property. Steve Morgan at Redway is a, you know, case in point, starting off with essentially a bucket and spade, and now is a gazillionaire.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there are huge assumptions and prejudices against construction. I suppose if you think about construction being a career spent ankle deep in mud in all weathers, and, you know, simply putting one brick on top of another for the rest of your life, doesn't make it sound particularly alluring. But I suppose that's a lazy person's view of what construction's all about. And of course, we know that that's not true now. I mean, you look at some of the people working on, I was going to mention Crossrail, but it's always embarrassing to mention Crossrail these days. But I mean, that's a huge, some of the engineering on that project is mind-boggling. And some of the people who delivered it, notably a lot of women engineers and architects were involved with Crossrail, immensely capable people doing incredible jobs. And I think that if people think that, oh, construction is a low-tech, low glamour industry, then they look at people like the engineers working on Crossrail or any of the other big infrastructure projects for that matter, and you can see actually it's really challenging. There's a huge sense of achievement, and they need really skilled people, really, really bright people for these jobs. So maybe, I suppose, an engineer would need to go to university in order to get an engineering degree. But otherwise,
no, you can do that. I think, you don't have to actually be resident at university. You can
no, you
work.
You can do a degree
you
apprenticeship
can work and
do a now,
distance learning. You can do apprenticeship degrees. You can there's all sorts of ways in.
That is true.
I should say the Redrow report on, or the Redrow survey on attitudes, it's not like suddenly saying no one wants to go to university. It is quite a subtle shift. But it's you know, more than a third of 16 to 21 year olds are less likely to choose university than they were before COVID. Mm. So it doesn't mean say they're not going to go, but there is a movement in that direction. And I asked CITB, they run a website called, it's called Go Construct. I always want to say Go Compare, but that's something different altogether. and it's essentially a careers guidance website.
Yeah.
And I imagined that visits to that or clicks on that would have gone up a lot during lockdown, the first lockdown, or since the first lockdown, when it became clear that construction was an industry where there were jobs to be had, whereas so many other sectors you couldn't get a job. And it was a bit disappointingly difficult to work out. They sent me reams of data about their visits to Go Construct, and it seems like
they're going to have to change that.
It seems like it was, the picture was made opaque by the various campaigns that they'd done. They talked about organic clicks and feed through clicks and things like that, and I got a bit lost on what all the data meant. But there does seem to be, they assure me that there is evidence that from the CITB that there is a rise in interest, an upturn in interest in construction. The flip side, though, is that there's a downturn in apprenticeships over the past year.
Oh, really?
By something like a third. Because all the big construction companies have got their office-type people working from home, and a lot of them have laid off 10% of their workforce because their turnover's 10% down over the past year, then they're feeling shy about taking on apprentices at the moment. It's all a bit sort of on the back burner, that side mm-hmm. of thing. Mm. No doubt it will come back as soon as we get back to whatever normal looks like. But there has been a bit of a downturn. And I want to talk about the CITB report about what we need. And this is all about the need to retrofit the built environment mm. to make it less carbon hungry, to decarbonise the built environment. Construction Industry Training Board has modelled the skills profile of the workforce needed to deliver net zero. It shows by 2028 we'll need an additional 86,000 project managers, 33,000 building envelope specialists, which includes glaziers and insulation people, I think, and 59,000 plumbers and HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning specialists. Mm-hmm. And altogether, talking about 350,000 additional skilled workers just for the net zero bit of it all by 2028. And I looked at this and I thought, and then so I was reading this thing, wow, 59,000 plumbers and HVAC specialists. And then I was looking at the Construction Leadership Council report that came out about the same time, and it said that it quoted another CITB report from the Construction Skills Network, saying that actually we'll need fewer plumbers in 2023 than we did in 2019. It's saying currently we've got 163,000 people in plumbing and HVAC trades. Sorry, we've got 167,000 now, and in 2023 we'll need 163,000. So I'm trying to pull together. Right. One report says we need another 59,000 plumbers in HVAC trades, and one report says we don't need as many.
I think the problem is we've got too many reports.
I know. this is driving my confusion. And the other side of all of this is the whole off-site. If we're all moving off-site, we need people working in factories rather than on-site.
Yeah. This national retrofit. I'm finding it difficult to speak this morning. This national retrofit strategy that the Construction Leadership Council published, I think just before Christmas, wasn't it? Back in December 2020. One of the latest reports on that is that they say that they've now finished the consultation process and that they've got massive support from people in the industry about it. And this ties in with the CITB's supposed green army of 350,000 skilled construction workers needed by 2028, and as you point out, this is just to meet the government's built environment carbon targets, isn't it? It isn't necessarily what the construction industry as a whole needs to continue operating.
Exactly, this is RMI, repair, maintenance, to refurbish homes like you and I live in, which are out of date and leaky and run by bad fuels and. Yeah. Good fuels put in. I can't think. 28 million properties or something need
yes,
something.
I think that was it.
Something
yes,
done
28
to them.
Million. They 28 million homes contribute 20% of the country's carbon emissions. Apparently, that's what the retrofit strategy says. I mean, this because we've talked in the past, haven't we, about the Green Deal and the Green Homes grants, which have been fairly conspicuous failures, haven't they? And so the CLC...
The idea is right and solid, though. The idea of incentivising people to get a better boiler, it used to be, and now it's, or get double glazing, get insulation, put in solar panels and get rid of your gas boiler. It all makes sense, but it was piecemeal. There was no strategy.
It was the execution.
There wasn't a coherent strategy. And this is what the whole Construction Leadership Council strategy is all about. It's actually saying, hang on a minute, let's think it through, let's make it long term,
yes.
Let's find a big picture here and make it work.
What I don't know is, I mean, the CLC, the Construction Leadership Council, has said that, you know, they've completed the consultation period and that they've got about 50 industry organisations backing them up on this. I don't know if there's been any response from the government. Do you? Have you heard anything from any government departments about what they think, or are they not required to consult on this?
Well, the government, let's not forget, is on the Construction Leadership Council. Construction Leadership Council,
yeah, so it is.
Its executive is administered by BEIS, the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy.
Yeah.
I think that's imminent. They will come out with that. Because what we had this morning from BEIS, the Department of Business and Energy, is what they call an industrial decarbonisation strategy. And there are two aspects to this. One is best part of £1 billion going to local authorities for retrofitting public sector buildings, town halls, council houses, colleges and so on, hospitals. Example, Leicester City Council's getting £24 million to upgrade 93 buildings and 56 schools, replacing natural gas heating with air source heat pumps, installing LED lighting, solar panels, insulation, etc.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole long list of these things. That's one half of it, the public sector decarbonisation scheme. And it's a short jump from that to the housing retrofit strategy.
Yes.
That the Construction Leadership Council is pioneering. The second part of this industrial decarbonisation strategy is seed corn funding. Basically, funding for, I mean, it's big money. It's sort of, you know, tens of millions of pounds. But it's for engineering studies and proof of concept kind of thing for various regional initiatives to for carbon storage and capture projects. There's one to transport a pipeline to transport hydrogen around the place in is that Humberside?
Oh yes, okay.
And so they're these sort of big industrial coalitions who are coming together, consortiums coming together. One of them in the northwest involves, for example, a Hanson Cement Works will be part of it, and it will reduce the cement's carbon challenge. And I got a little bit of a slap on the wrist the other day from, who was it? Tarmac have brought out a new plastic bag for their cement.
Oh, that's
and
right,
it's now,
yes.
It's now
yes.
got 50% recycled content in the plastic bag instead of 30% recycled content in the plastic bag. And I report it slightly tongue-in-cheek, saying, you know, yippee, that makes your cement much cleaner.
More flags.
and I was right to point out, perhaps being a little bit unfair, because it is all baby steps. I mean, all these cement companies are, they have, as an industry, I think they've reduced their carbon footprint by something like 50% in the past 5 or 10 years. I mean, they've made great strides. There's still a long way to go. But it's all these little tiny footprints. Dave Brailsford, the cycling man, who talks about, Clive Woodward, but talking about these sort of incremental.
There's a Brailsford chap, the incremental improvements. Yes, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So they all matter.
Let's not talk about British cycling.
Well, we shouldn't. Yes.
It's not all good news, but I agree. It's interesting, actually, and we haven't really discussed this an awful lot about the cement industry. Of course, cement is one of the most carbon intensive industries in the entire world, and they know it. So they have been doing an awful lot. I mean, when you think about it, if I was the chief executive of a cement producer, I'd probably throw my hands up in despair and say, "There's nothing we can do about it." You know, we burn huge amounts of fossil fuels to make this concrete, and we can't clean up our act. But actually, they've taken the bull by the horns, and they seem to be doing a lot. There are all sorts of little things, as you say, being done. And I think a lot of people now appreciate the carbon impact of the cement and concrete industry.
Yes, the efforts of the cement industry do lead on to what we're going to talk about in a minute. But before we leave the subject of apprentices and training and this sort of thing, I gather you've got an interesting article on this topic in the next issue of Construction Index magazine that is in the works.
Well, that is true. Yeah, we've just gone to press with that. I think it's being mailed out as I speak. Yes, I was contacted by a company we've written about before, actually, Lee Marley Brickwork, which is a big brickwork contractor, mainly operating in the southeast of England, although they've just opened a Scottish office, I believe, but that's beside the point. They realised they had a problem with training and their apprentices. Very soon, in the first lockdown, I think they've got about 21 apprentices on their books at the moment, something like that. They realised that this was going to disrupt their training, and of course, to begin with, it's going to disrupt everything because we had the lockdown, the first lockdown, sites closed, and things started to get back to normal. But it was when a second lockdown started, and of course, colleges and schools all closed, and this obviously put the brakes on the learning that the apprentices were doing in college, because they'd be doing their one day a week in college and 4 days out on site where they'd be mentored but not really taught. And Lee Marley, rather cleverly, I suppose, had been working with a very hyperactive trainer, a chap called Christian Hatherall Good, who was head of the construction module at Brooklands College, which I think is in Surrey, Weybridge in Surrey. And he had, that's where Lee Marley sent all their apprentices. And Christian was very keen, as I said, when I said hyperactive, I didn't mean that disparagingly.
Energetic, I think is a positive
energetic
term.
And imaginative. And he was already recording like YouTube videos, sort of how-to videos, and using social media to basically top up the training, if you like, the theory training that the apprentices were getting throughout the week, and not just confining it to one day. So they would get stuff sent to them which they could read through and work on when they're traveling to work or in the evenings, this sort of thing,
as part of their college training.
And when all the colleges closed, what Christian did was he actually started, well, the first thing was that Lee Marley actually poached him from Brooklands College. He left the college to go and join Lee Marley, which he did last summer, I believe. And the students, the apprentices are still enrolled at Brooklands College. They still work there. And Christian works closely with his replacement at the college. But he, when the college was closed, he took the training out onto the site. He was traveling around the site, you know, with his mask on and doing all the social distancing and all the rest of it. So he was providing a lot of stuff through social media and online and that kind of thing. He'd also actually, he'd been asked by NOCRM, the National... what does that stand for now? I can't remember. The National Open College Network, NOCN.
They do the CSCS cards and all that sort of thing now.
That's right, yeah. Well, they'd asked Christian to actually make some of these videos, so he was already doing stuff for them, for their construction support materials program. Anyway, so he was doing all that, and then he was going out onto site and actually teaching the apprentices on site, on live sites. So they'd find a quiet corner maybe of the site, and he'd show them how to, you know, how to construct a particular bit of brickwork, a particular technique, something like that. And then he'd go to them to the work phase where they're actually working, and he would actually oversee them while they were working, and actually provide them with practical tuition. As he pointed out, you know, their site tuition isn't really tuition. They're mentored. They've got a senior bricklayer who they're working alongside. They can watch him. But he's got a full-time job to do. He can't afford to slow down in order to teach these apprentices. So they can learn on the job, but they're not getting, if you like, the theoretical tuition that they would have got in college on every Friday, every week. But they were, because Christian was going out there to provide it on site. To cut a long story short, this worked really well, and he and Lee Marley, the eponymous owner of the company, are planning to set up a brickwork academy, a Lee Marley brickworking academy.
Excellent. Where will that be?
You've got me now. I think. Well, Lee Marley is headquartered in Reading, so I imagine that's probably where it would be. But I'm not actually sure. It might be somewhere else. But certainly, they want to set up this academy and provide their own training and their own curriculum, if you like. One of the things that Christian says in the article is that, you know, the colleges have their curriculum, they have to follow the curriculum, but a lot of the work that Lee Marley is doing now is using sort of more modern techniques. He didn't actually go into detail about what those techniques were, but different techniques, new materials, that kind of thing. So they want to provide specific training on the stuff that's being used out on site right now, as well as the traditional bricklaying skills, which of course provides the basis of all the learning. So yeah, they're planning to do that, and they're going to use a lot of the online and social media techniques that they've used. They're still going to go and visit apprentices on site, and so they're taking a slightly different approach to training now, and it's all evolved over the last year or so as a result of the COVID disruption. So they now think they've got a more flexible, more inclusive, more relevant training model than they had this time last year. Well,
clearly it's tailored absolutely to their need, and it sounds a fantastic initiative. But it does remind me that one of the things I read, some of the things I've been reading in several of these reports, is that while it's entirely appropriate that Lee Marley Brickwork should be running training on brickwork, because that's its business and that's mm-hmm. the skills that it needs, the industry as a whole, it is said that the thrust of training is a little bit over-focused on these traditional skills, and there's mm-hmm. not enough training on things that we are going to need more of in the future, like off-site manufacturing and the digital skills required mm-hmm. in that. And going back to the national retrofit strategy, apparently the CITB say that outside of the social housing market, there's hardly any activity in training energy efficiency retrofitting and very little capacity for it. So there needs to be much more, the construction industry training needs to be a lot more focused on, or there needs to be a much bigger push on training people in RMI, yeah. Basically.
Going back to what you were saying earlier about the retrofit strategy, is that a lot of the skills aren't, if you like, traditional construction skills. I suppose a lot of the plumbing and stuff like that is all fairly familiar.
You say that, but I bet most plumbers wouldn't know what to do with an air source or a ground source heat pump, would they?
Well, no, yeah, that's true. Yeah, maybe connecting the pipes, maybe, and wiring up the sensors and the pumps probably isn't that different. But yes, this is a different technology. I mean, an air source or ground source heat pump doesn't work the same way as a gas boiler. So I suppose, yes, there are skills, new skills, emerging skills that perhaps there isn't the training for at the moment, or there isn't sufficient training for. But I think there's one of the problems facing the industry is obviously we know that there's a chronic shortage of all skills from site to boardroom, really, in the industry. And it's always a problem. It's one of these perennial problems which doesn't seem to go away. But in terms of site skills, actual building skills, there's a wider range of skills required now. It's not... I thought that apprentices and building trainees were being trained in the wrong sort of skills, or in a very narrow sort of range of skills. For example, in terms of materials, for example, because when I discovered this when I lived in a house which was built out of cob and covered with lime mortar, lime render, was that...
I'm sorry, was that your house is built out of carbon or cardboard?
Built out of mud, actually. In fact, the one I live in now is still built out of the same materials. It's not as old. But this is one of the things which I noticed, was that whenever I needed somebody to do some work to the house, and it didn't need a lot of work doing to it, you would get a traditional mason or bricklayer, and you would have a traditional plasterer. And they were used to dealing with cementitious materials and gypsum-based materials. And if you mention anything like cob or lime to them, they recoiled. This was some sort of rather exotic material, and it required out-of-date techniques. And it was all considered a little bit hippie-ish. That isn't the case quite so much now. But I think the thing was that they were being trained to use modern materials, which is, of course, what is used in 99% of buildings. But there was a gap in the skill set for repair and maintenance of traditional buildings, and in fact the word traditional, I noticed, was misappropriated, because traditional construction actually meant the modern stuff. So cement renders rather than lime renders. The lime render stuff was particularly odd. In fact, there's one person in part of the West Country where I live who very quickly cottoned onto it, and he's for a long time now he's been the go-to person for anything lime orientated, and he's a rather energetic sort of chap with a lot of long hair, and to be uncharitable, does look a bit hippie-ish. I haven't seen him for a long time, so he might have had a haircut since.
But doubt it. No one else has in the past year.
But the thing was that this chap is well known. People who are in the know, people who want, if you want lime, you go to this chap. But he wasn't your traditional builder. And in fact, when I had some work done on the house I live in now, which was completely covered with a cement render, which had failed, and I had to have it all taken off and a lime render put on instead, the chap who was doing it, local plasterer who was doing it, was very suspicious about this. I said I wanted lime, and he said, well, I've done some little bits of this and that and the other, but only sort of repair work, nothing big, but he was up for it. Anyway, the chap I was buying the lime from came along, and he was a rather sort of academic looking type chap. He didn't look like a builder, but he knew all about lime and how it should be used. And he came along and he gave my plasterer a morning's tuition in how to use it, you know, how to, you know, you need to let it mix for much, much longer than cement, for example. And you had to use reinforcing fibers in it and this, that and the other. It required special techniques. And I could see that my plasterer was bridling at this, because there was this chap who clearly wasn't a plasterer telling him how to do his job. But I mean, he did, to give him his due, he wasn't so proud that he just ignored it and did his own thing. He actually took this bloke at his word, and he did an excellent job. But again, sorry, this is all a very long-winded way of saying that here was a tradesman who had been trained traditionally using traditional skills, which weren't what I would call traditional skills. They were modern skills for modern materials. And so I think now there's much more awareness of traditional building, certainly in the area I live. You know, it isn't a lime monopoly just held by one person now. Traditional skills are far more widespread, but, you know, that was a learning process.
As soon as you talk about lime, though, I'm thinking you're not talking about traditional, you're more into talking about heritage, which is, you know,
yes, heritage,
comes before tradition.
Yeah, I suppose so. But so, I've been ranting on for ages, but I think that what I'm trying to say is that there's a huge range of skills now. Because we're more aware of, let's use that word, heritage buildings now, there has been an upswing in the amount of training in traditional or heritage crafts, which I think is fantastic. And at the same time, we've had this growing awareness of energy-saving techniques and modern techniques, which also need to be introduced to the curriculum alongside the heritage and the traditional techniques. So you've got a much, much wider range of skills required in the industry now. And I think that, you know, that will only expand as we go forward. I don't think that we'll ever see a narrowing of the skills required in the industry from now on.
Going back to the national retrofit strategy, if we're talking about heritage buildings, the village I live in, a lot of old properties. Mine isn't that old, but there's one road I can see from my office window where I think just about every house on it is listed. And then I've yet to hear or read serious discussion about how the whole retrofit drive is going to apply to listed buildings, because as I said the other week, we're talking about the chap who wrote to the paper saying he wanted to get rid of his flammable thatched roof. He wasn't yes. allowed to because his house was listed. And the idea of putting in whatever ground source heat pumps or solar panels on a listed building, I think it's a right old hornet's nest, and might have to make some compromises there, or just say, okay, if you're a listed building, you're allowed to be carboniferous.
Well, I think there is a sort of a compromise required for this, because I mean, a lot of people, I think there's a lot of misconceptions for a start about the listing process. You know, you can't do this to a listed building, or the only things actually covered are the things specifically mentioned in a listing. So if you know, if you go on the English Heritage website and look up a listed building, and it'll tell you it's got certain type of sash windows and this, that, and the other, and it'll mention some of the architectural features of it, and a lot of people assume that those are the only things we're actually protecting. Anything else you can do, no, if everything within the curtilage of the property is protected by a listing, and you can't just go in there, and because the old Victorian fireplace isn't mentioned, means you can knock it out and put
you can't do anything. You're stuck.
No, you can't. No. Well, but the sort of heritage building fraternity, if you like, there's always compromise. I mean, they appreciate these buildings. You can't just keep them and render them useless. People need to live in them. People need to use them and work in them. And so, although there's always room for compromise, because you can't expect somebody to live in a listed building which is dangerous or insanitary or just plain freezing cold.
No, but if you want a nice modern open plan kitchen, for example, which you know, so many people
you might not be able to
can't
do that.
Do things like that.
No. Well, that's fair enough. But I think that within reason, obviously, you've got to be able to use these buildings. There's no point rendering them completely useless, and unless it's going to be a museum. And then I suppose you have a separate use. Let's move on. And we're still talking about green
and,
issues.
And finally, green.
Yes, and finally. Yeah, tell us, because this was quite an interesting article that you wanted to discuss in particular, I think.
Yeah, well, I was immediately interested when I started reading this, and I confess that as you and I discussed the details, we thought, okay, maybe it's not quite that exciting, but it's kind of fun. Bits of all plastic wind turbine blades are going to be shredded to be used instead of steel rebar to reinforce concrete on parts of the HS2 project. And he thought, first of all, plastic instead of steel for rebar? Interesting. Okay, it's not just plastic, it's
well, there's glass in there, of course.
Yeah, it's fibre-reinforced composite material.
Glass fibre, yeah.
But the other thing that struck me is, my doesn't time fly quickly. We're already talking about recycling old wind turbine blades. I thought that it all knew these things, and already some of them are reaching end of life. Maybe it's just coming down for bigger turbines, I don't know. But
well, I had exactly the same thought, and so I Googled what's the lifespan of a wind turbine. And the answer came up, and I can't remember where it was, 20 years, in fact. I found an article in the LA Times, Los Angeles Times. That's Google for you. They wrote a piece about this last year, actually, about wind turbine blades, because 20 years ago, all these turbines were going up. So a lot of them are reaching the end of their lifespan now. And according to the LA Times, they've got nowhere to go except landfill. There are other uses, and I think that the story, because this is just to give a bit of background to this story, we're talking about HS2, yeah, aren't we? This is a story put out by HS2, the Skanska Costain Strabag joint venture, which is building the southern section of HS2 phase one. It wants to take these old turbine blades, which have reached the end of their lives, saw them up into strips, presumably, and then use them to reinforce concrete. And I thought, that's fantastic. That's quite amazing, because I could see that they were going to be used for sort of bridge piers and bridge decks and flyovers.
Nothing
and stuff
so
like
important.
That. But I would know nothing quite so so exciting as that. They're going to be used for things like temporary access roads and
site compounds,
concrete slabs for site compounds. And I didn't even know you needed any reinforcement in a site access road. I thought you just put down a bit of hardcore, ran a vibrating roller over it, and it was there for the next 5 months, and then you dug it up and took it away. But no, they're going to use these wind turbines. And I think they said that there are uses for them. What the one that I found particularly intriguing, although they didn't go into details, is that they can be reused as children's slides. I thought, a slide made out of... I like the sound of that. In fact, I'd have a go on one of those. Because, I mean, you know, they're very swooping and curved and all the rest of it. I don't know whether or not they would just use the... take the blade off and lay it down and let the kids clamber all over it. Maybe not. They'd probably do something else with it. Or you could grind them up and pelletize them and use them for, I don't know, something else. But SCS, the Skanska Costain Strabag joint venture, somebody was quoted saying, well, what we, all we're doing is sawing them up into strips. And of course, that's a lot less energy intensive than grinding them into pellets or breaking them down in any other way. And they're just, so they're going to get strips of this stuff, presumably, and just include them in the mix. I don't know how they're going to do it, whether or not they're going to be long strips used like rebar, or if they're going to be short strips like fibers. I don't know.
We get quite a lot of interesting materials stories, new uses of old things, particularly in, whether it's in concrete mixtures or road pavings or whatever, you know, recycled fizzy pop bottles and things like that. There are all sorts of these initiatives to anything to stop things going into landfill that can be used in a useful, hidden, out of the way way. Personally, I'm not sure I'd want to hide and chop up these wind turbine blades. I'd be inclined to give them all to Anthony Gormley, the fabulous sculptor man, and say, there you go, Gormo, do your stuff. Here's some raw material for you, and let him do something brilliant with it.
Also, I thought that the more I looked at this story, the less convinced I was about it. Because apart from the fact that the structures which they're talking about reinforcing with these old wind turbine blades aren't structures which typically I thought needed an awful lot of reinforcement.
If this is a new approach, though, a new material, it's got to go through all the testing process and years of, you know, old... our friends at the BBA would have to sit on it for a year and chew over it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, okay, I take your point. But then if they're going to saw up these old turbine blades and then use them for reinforcement in temporary structures, I think they're all temporary structures, aren't they? I mean, they're talking about site compound bases.
It sounds like it, yes.
Well, they're going to be digging them up again in a few months' time. And then we're back to square one. We've got all this glass-reinforced plastic, only this time it's all encased in concrete. And we've got to get rid of it again. So is it really that green? They're just delaying the inevitable, aren't they?
I think we need to do more work on this story.
And another thing, and maybe I'm being cynical. You know, I'm not a great fan of HS2, and I've never made any secret of that.
Oh, off with you.
I know you are. I mean, you think it's great. I'm not convinced, and I do think that it's environmentally very damaging. And I think that HS2 are putting out a lot of these environmental type of stories at the moment, and I think they're very keen to push anything green to just offset the negative publicity surrounding the impact that the project's going to have on landscape and the countryside. And it's been described by, obviously, there are plenty of campaigning groups against HS2. One of them described it as the largest deforestation project this country has seen since the First World War. And so, you know, they're getting all this bad publicity. They've got, what's his name?
Chris Packham,
I can never remember the chap's name. Obviously, he's a bit of a thorn in their side at the moment. So anything that can offset, and there's a loaded term, anything that can offset the negative publicity surrounding the environmental impact of HS2 is going to be bigged up. And I think that's what's happening here because then I wouldn't discourage people from doing something like this. It's, as you say, we have to explore the options. And obviously, if you've got wind turbines reaching the end of their lives after just 20 years, and we've got to do something with them. So maybe that's something. But
I don't have a problem with HS2 trumpeting their innovations and interesting things that are going on. It's a huge, great project. There are masses of interesting, good things going on that we don't hear about. I just wish they didn't have gagging orders signed on all their supply chain, and the little people who are working on the project doing great things aren't allowed to talk about it.
I didn't realise that, but I'm not surprised. Have you run up against a wall of silence?
I haven't even bothered trying because I know they're all gagged and they're not allowed to talk. You know, it's a shame.
I have found that the HS2 press office is very good at putting out stories, but he won't respond to any inquiries I make. I was quite interested in taking a closer look at one of the infrastructure contracts. I won't say what it is because I don't want to identify anybody. But they were all very, the press officer I spoke to was all very much in favour. We can sort something out and get you speaking to the right people. I never heard anything, and I followed it up, chased people a couple of times, and in the end I gave up because there was no response effectively. So
I've not had that experience. I often get upset that not enough of the smaller people down the supply chain are credited where they should be.
Yeah.
And in fact, the company I'm about to mention is not in any way shaped small, but it's a tier two in this context, Keller. They put out a press release this week saying that piling work has started on the Cone Valley Viaduct. It's going to be the country's longest rail bridge. And they didn't even say who was doing the piling. So I said, OK, it's great piling started. Are you going to tell us who's doing it? And quick as a flash, they emailed back with a story I myself had posted a couple of weeks ago about saying who'd got the piling contract, which is Keller. They said, here you go, a link to my own story.
Oh, fantastic.
I think we're straying into the territory of journalists grumbling about press officers, which might make an interesting discussion to lose lots of friends and alienate people in another week, but maybe not one for now so much.
Yeah, all right then. But stop while we're ahead, if we're still ahead.
I think once again, David, we've gone over far longer than our allotted 30 minutes, which is all we're expected to produce. But hey, we're happy chatting all the time. So
yeah.
But for this week, are we over and out, David? Are we done?
I think that's it. I could go on, but I shan't.
Well, thank you, everyone, once again for listening. Usual messages. Thank you to our sponsors very much indeed. You can contact us by email podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find more about what we talked about at The Construction Index. Or if you want the horse's mouth, you probably need to go to the CITB or the Construction Leadership Council websites for all those various reports, which confuse the hell out of me for all the masses of information thrown away to me. We'll be back again same time next week. Cheerio.
Okay, see you then.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from The Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.